Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest today will be Patty LoVera from the Food and Water Watch. And I can't wait to invite her on and tell you more about her. But first, I want to just talk about some things going on in and around the news and some things going on in and around our local city. First off, I was so surprised reading about radon coming into our apartments through the Spectra pipeline that is being proposed. Right now, you know, we have banned fracking in New York, but we have not banned bringing fracked gas into New York. And the fracked gas that's being brought into New York from Pennsylvania contains radon, which has no odor and is being piped into New York City apartments. And with the Spectra pipeline that is being proposed, that is going to really, that program is really going to grow. And so on my website, there's more information about this Spectra pipeline. There's actually a short video you can look at, and I recommend all of you to do that to find out more about that. Also, I was reading about, we've all been very concerned about pesticides on our produce, talking about it for years, but this was a new report associating the use of pesticides and ingesting lots of pesticides with low sperm count in men. And I thought that was really incredibly interesting. And with so much of the fertility problems going on, so often it's presume that it's the women having the problems, and it can also be caused by a low sperm count with the men. So, you know, another reason to eat organic, go onto the Environmental Working Group's website and find out about the Dirty Dozen. They actually talked about the Dirty Dozen in the article and said, you know, really try to avoid those 12 vegetables and fruits that they say are most heavily spread. We've also been hearing lots of news about the neonicotinoids that are the pesticides that are being linked to the diminished bee colonies, bee claps. And in many European countries and in Australia and Canada, they have banned this. And our country has been fighting the ban for a long time. Finally, the EPA has agreed to put a moratorium on the use of the neonicotinoids for now. I don't know how long that moratorium will last, but if we keep up the pressure, and that means all of us, hopefully we can get rid of those. They are really, really bad news. Just like the weed killer Roundup, that has also been in the news again. We know, those of us that are paying attention, know that Roundup is bad for us, and we want to get that off our plates. But our government, as I've talked about so many times, are so in bed with the biotech companies that make the chemicals, talking about Monsanto, DuPont, that we're not getting our fair protection by our governmental agencies. And so this is another article that was written about glyphosate, which is, you know, its other name is Roundup, and how this is really causing cancer. And they are showing links, and, you know, so often this kind of information is suppressed because they don't want us to know, but we all need to know. And I'm sure we'll be talking more about that with my guest in just a little bit. I want to share with you some things going on in and around the city. Tonight, a film called Biophilia is going to be being presented. It's Biophilia Theater Presents Back to Eden. It's going to be showed at the Cornell Cooperative Extension, the NASA office in East Meadow, this evening at 7 o'clock. And this is about sustainable organic gardening methods being used around the world. Really great documentary. If you can make it, I think it will be really worthwhile. This weekend, the Josh Levine Memorial Cocktail Party is happening out in Sag Harbor. You can find out more information about that on the Slow Food East End website. There's a rally on April 13th to tell Governor Cuomo to veto the Port Ambrose liquefied natural gas site that they are planning or proposing to build off the coast of Long Beach and Manhattan and New Jersey, right there in the middle. Way too close for comfort. Should anything happen, a site like that is certainly a terrorist target, and we are living in a world where that actually has to be considered, unfortunately. You don't want that right out in your harbor. Plus, it is the same location that they're talking about a wind farm, and we all know that a wind farm would be much better moving forward, getting us off of non-renewable resources, going towards renewable resources, and that's where we want to go. So if you can join that rally, it's at 27 West 44th Street, only from 11:15 to 1. So it's during lunch hour. So if you can make it, you work in the city, please come on down. They could use your support. Also a rally in the city, April 15th, the Fight for 15. That is a national campaign going on across the country to raise awareness about minimum paid workers who are working full-time and can't support their families. I mean, do the math. 40 hours a week times 7.75 or whatever minimum wage is in Manhattan right now, you just can't feed your family on that. And we need to raise that up. And I realize, as a small business owner myself, that, you know, minimum wage, you know, if it's $15 for everyone and you want to be paying more than minimum wage, that's a tough call for a small company. But most of the companies we're talking about are the big companies like McDonald's, fast food companies, Walmart. They certainly can come up with the $15 an hour. So if you can come on out to support that, it'd be great. April 17th, Sustainable Long Island, which is a great nonprofit working here on Long Island to regentrify different downtown areas that have really been in financial disarray for years. They're really working together, and they have their annual conference this coming actually a week from Friday, April 17th, from 8 to 2 at Carlisle on the Green at Bethpage Park. If you can make it to that, go onto the Sustainable Long Island website to find out more information to get your tickets. April 17th is an earth-friendly lecture at the Sustainable Studies Program at Stony Brook University. This is actually a fundraiser for their students, and it's at a residential home. So you can find out more information about that at the Sustainable Studies website at Stony Brook University. April 22nd, Plating the Planet, a memorable evening of minds, scientists, poets, and chefs, all coming out in support of the biodiversity work of the Crop Trust and Slow Food USA. That's at the United Nations at 6 p.m. On the same day, Carlo Petrini, the founder of Slow Food, will be there at this dinner. But also, Carlo will also be signing his new book at Eataly in the afternoon. I'm not exactly sure what time. I think it's 2 p.m., but if you go to the Slow Food USA website, I'm sure you can find out more about the book signing. April 23rd, Sustainable Living Film Series, being put on by Molloy College's Sustainable Program, and that is out at the Suffolk County Center, 6 p.m. on April 23rd, and the film is called A Fierce Green Fire, The Battle for a Living Planet. Also should be great. April 25th, that's the one I really want to plug here. This is the Long Island Food Conference. It is going to be an unbelievable day at Hofstra University. Our keynote speaker is Stephen Ritz from the Green Bronx Machine. We have panels of chefs. We have panels talking about sustainability, talking about food labeling, talking about GMOs, talking about beekeeping. You name it. If it's about food, there will be something on that topic at Hofstra that day, April 25th. You don't want to miss it. It is our third Long Island Food Conference. The other two were also incredibly great, and this one is going to be as well. So please come. I will be doing a cooking demo during the lunch panel. I'll also be moderating the chef panel. So please come on down at Hofstra on April 25th.
Tickets are only $25 if you buy them soon. They go up to $35 at the door. So get your tickets. May 2nd, the 4th Annual Food and Travel Expo, and that's at Brooklyn Borough Hall. May 5th is a screening of GMO-OMG, a great documentary on genetically modified organisms, and that's happening at the Clubhouse in Merrick at 7 p.m. You can find out more information about all of these things on my website at iegreen.com. Just go to events and you can find out about that. I want to share a recipe with you before I invite my guest on. This recipe is tofu cutlets with cherry tomatoes, capers, and white wine. And you're going to, these are the ingredients that you need. You need a cake of tofu. I always buy the extra firm unless I'm, you know, making a stew and cooking it in the soup, something like that. But otherwise, I get the extra firm tofu. If you can find one that's already sprouted, it's that much more nutritious. So I usually try to look for a sprouted one. A half a cup of panko flakes and a half a cup of breadcrumbs, two eggs, a quarter teaspoon of salt and a quarter teaspoon of pepper, 3 tablespoons olive oil, 2 tablespoons minced garlic, half an onion diced fine, 1 shallot minced, a pint of heirloom cherry tomatoes quartered, and I found cherry tomatoes that are different colors because it just makes it that much prettier, 2 tablespoons capers, 1 tablespoon chopped parsley, 1/4 cup of white wine, and salt and pepper to taste. And anytime I'm sautéing my cutlets, I always lay the tofu out first. I cut them into slices about 1/4 inch thick, lay them out on a dry towel, and then cover them with another dry towel and lightly press them. You can even put a cookie sheet on top as a weight and just let them sit there for 5-10 minutes before actually using them. And that just helps to remove the water that they're compact in. Then you're going to take 2 pie plates, and you can, in one, you're going to combine the breadcrumbs, the panko flakes, salt and pepper, and then in the other, you're going to beat the eggs. And you're going to dip the tofu slices first into the egg mixture and then into the breadcrumb mixture, and you're going to saute them in a heavy skillet with some olive oil. And you're going to brown them on both sides. And then you're not going to probably fit them all in one pan at one time. So once you do one round, wipe the pan clean, and then repeat with the remaining tofu cutlets until they're all fried up golden brown on all sides. And then you're quickly going to make the sauce, and it's very quick. You're going to, again, wipe out the pan. If you can reuse the same pan, it's always great. Add another tablespoon of olive oil. Sauté the onions and the shallots until they become translucent, and that's about medium heat for about 5 minutes. Then you're going to add the capers and the tomatoes. Let those cook just a few minutes. Then add the wine and the salt and pepper to taste, and then the fresh parsley. And then put them on top of the tofu cutlets, and I, you know, garnish them right down the middle. I have a pretty picture on my website if you want to see it. And then just sprinkle some fresh parsley over the whole thing, and that's it. The flavor from the sauce, you know, goes right into the tofu cutlets, which, as you know, have tofu cutlets by themselves, or tofu by itself, has very little flavor. So you're really just taking the fresh flavor from the wine, the tomatoes, the garlic, the capers, and you know, that's really enhancing every bite. So it's really a great recipe, very quick, and beautiful presentation. Okay, and now we get to my favorite part of the show. I get to invite on my guest, Patty Lovera. As I said, Patty is the Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch. She coordinates the food team. And she has a bachelor's degree in environmental science from Lehigh University, a master's degree in environmental policy from the University of Michigan. And before joining Food and Water Watch, Patty was the deputy director of energy and environment program at the Public Citizen, and which is a research center for health, environment, and justice. Patty, are you with me?
Yes. Hi.
Hi. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Sure. So Food and Water Watch is one of my favorite organizations. When I'm looking for, you know, relevant information, I always know I can go to your website and find the information I need. I know they've been working a lot on passing the GMO law in New York State. Can you share with us
where that is right now. You know, I've been talking to my audience for a long time about GMOs, so most of my audience is aware of the problems of them, of GMOs. But can you share with them what's going on with the bill and how we can all work to help get this passed in New York State?
Sure. So we're working in a couple states. New York is one of the most important for a couple reasons. For many, many years, the federal government has just completely failed on this issue of either regulating GMOs properly or even the basic issue of letting people know where they are in the food supply. So we do not have a requirement, you know, at the federal level for labeling. And so a lot of folks over the last 3 or 4 years have really been working very, very hard at the state level to get states to require this. And so Connecticut and Maine have passed laws that would require GMO labeling, but their laws don't kick into effect until their neighboring states have a law as well, which makes New York really important. Vermont passed a law last year that doesn't have that string attached, but they're still working on getting that into effect because of a legal challenge, right? So New York is really important for getting this ball rolling of getting a bunch of states to require labeling. So there's a bill it's working its way through the assembly. It's already passed one committee, and we hope to have it out of a second committee, I think the Codes Committee, pretty soon. Then it has one more committee after that, and then it would go to the floor of the assembly, and then it could go over to the Senate. So there's a lot of steps, but it's moving in the right direction. There's great, great folks working on it, great momentum, and there's actually something people can do. At the end of the month, there's going to be a big rally on April 28th in Albany where people are going to rally at the Capitol and say, hey, legislators, we need you to pass this bill. And so there's information on our Facebook page, Food and Water Watch, and there's also a group called GMO Free New York that has information about how you can get on a bus and go up to Albany.
Great, great. I know we, meaning myself and a whole group from Slow Food Long Island, were on the bus the last time. It's a great day for those of you that haven't gone. I really recommend if you can make the time to do that. You really feel like you're doing something when you go, so it's great.
And they notice it. Yeah, they see those people gathering there, and they know they have to pay attention. So it works.
Right. So right now our country is left for each state to try to do this on their own as opposed to a national bill. And right now, isn't there a national – There's a national bill that they're trying to push through that's the opposite of a GMO protection law. It's actually a law that is going to prevent states from being able to make their own law. Isn't that correct?
Right. There's actually both sides of it. We have a good bill and a bad bill in Congress.
On the national level?
On the national level. So there's a bill in both the House and the Senate that would require labeling. So it's Representative DeFazio from Oregon sponsored that and Senator Boxer from California. So that's the bill we want, right, because it would have a national, you know, a national requirement for labeling. At the same time, though, you know, the industry, the biotechnology industry, the big food processors, they've been fighting these state proposals all over the place. It's costing them time and money to fight them. So they're looking for a solution to block labeling at the federal level. They have a bill, so far it's just in the House, and that we all call the DARK Act. We say it's denying Americans the right to know, and it would preempt the states. It would say states are not allowed to require this labeling, only the feds can, and then it has a bunch of other junk in there that would basically make it impossible for the feds to require labeling. So it's really anti-consumer, you know, anti-labeling, trying to get their dirty work done in D.C.
Mm-hmm. And is there a petition or something that people can sign to oppose the DARK Act, to let their senators and congressmen know that they don't want a national bill like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have stuff on our website at foodandwaterwatch.org. A bunch of other groups are working on this, too. There's a pretty big healthy coalition working on this to make sure they don't block, you know, all this great work that's going on at the states. We want to make sure they don't take that option away in Congress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, there's a whole group of us that are believers with the dangers of GMOs, but there's, of course, the whole group of people that say it's hogwash, that there's no, you know, that they're the same. That's partly why our government's gotten away with not labeling it, because they say they're basically the same, GMO'd or not GMO'd. But we know that GMOs also affect the environment. They have an effect on climate change and our health. Can you share with my listeners, you know, some of the problems associated with GMOs when it comes to the environment and climate change?
Sure. So, you know, a lot of the attention and controversy around GMOs is on whether they're safe to eat, and that's important, obviously, right? And there's not a good system. The government system for approving these things does not look at the right things to answer the question, are they safe? So that's a legitimate debate, and we have to keep having that. But in addition to that, there's all these questions of what kind of food system are GMOs fitting into, right? And it's a really industrialized, chemically intensive, you know, kind of global trade, like just the biggest, you know, most industrial food system, that is what GMOs fit nicely into. So it's not a coincidence in our minds that the biggest, you know, purveyors of GMO seeds were chemical first, right? The Monsantos and Dows and DuPonts of the world. And then they acquired the technology to engineer seeds so that these crops could be sprayed with herbicides like Roundup or 2,4-D, which is infamous because it was an ingredient in Agent Orange as a defoliant. So these are weed killers, and they want to spray the crops with the weed killers and have the crops survive that spraying. And so not surprisingly, when you're kind of packaging the seeds and the chemicals together, you see an increase in the use of those chemicals. And so pretty quickly, you know, 15 years into this experiment of using a lot of GMO, you know, corn and soy and cotton, we now have weeds that are resistant to those herbicides, which is a growing problem for all parts of the country. It's kind of spreading across the country, these herbicide-resistant weeds. And that's taking us to a next generation of GMO crops that are engineered to withstand tougher herbicides like 2,4-D and dicamba that are, you know, possibly even more toxic. And so it's the model of agriculture is really, really troubling, and it's moving us, you know, in the wrong direction from where we need to go in terms of chemical use and monoculture and kind of all of that big industrialized stuff. And then we have a lot of questions about what do we know about the environmental impacts of these chemicals, you know, on farmers, farm workers, if it ends up in water supplies, and we're just not getting those questions answered properly.
Right. And, you know, most countries actually screen products for safety first before allowing them onto the market. Why is it that our country puts them on the market first and then it's up to you know, the consumer to prove that they're unsafe before getting them pulled off, as opposed to the other way around? Doesn't make sense.
Exactly, it's backwards. And this is, you know, this is true in our food supply. We have a lot of fights that are exactly about this core issue, right, of why is it on the market first before you've shown it's safe. It's true in, you know, our broader sectors of things, you know, like the different chemicals that are used in things, you know, whether it's cosmetics or things like that. In some regards, it's almost even true for the way that we approve drugs. It's just a backwards burden, right, of how you prove something is safe. And a lot of folks point to the European Union as a contrast, where they basically use something called the precautionary principle of if, unless you can show that it's safe. And they actually have a saying, you know, no data, no market, right? If you're not showing you're not producing the data to show long-term proof of safety, you shouldn't sell it, right? And I think that for common sense, that really strikes people as the way to go, but we do the opposite, and then we end up in these kind of fights of trying to prove harm later.
Right. You know, it just shows how our government really cares more about the corporations and their bottom line than they care about the health of the constituents that they're supposed to be protecting. It just does not make sense. Infuriates me, the whole thing.
Yeah, it's a core issue in a lot of these fights that we're having, and it boils down to they can have their lobbyists and their, you know, their expert scientists cast a lot of doubt and get people bogged down in details of, well, which study did you use, and we don't like that study, when the core issue should be this common sense approach of why is this on the market in the first place.
Mm-hmm. It also seems like we have to get more money, or the government has to choose to spend their money in different places. I mean, they have to spend money to do the testing. Right now, my understanding is that they trust the testing that the chemical companies do. So it's like, you know, they're allowing the companies that produce the chemical to provide the data rather than doing their own data. Is that true?
Right, and that's the way they're set up. I mean, that's by design. And that's – so we're very often – having arguments about new technologies using old laws and old regulations that are not up to the job. And so that's kind of a theme in our life in Water Watch, and a lot of folks who are tracking these issues, you'll hear things like that again and again. And so that's what we have to constantly be talking about. So this fight about labeling is a response to that. You know, there's whenever we have a fight about are GMOs healthy to eat, the industry is always like, well, people have been eating them for 20 years and we don't see any problems. We haven't told people they're eating them. We haven't identified where they are. So how can we say that there's no problems, right? You're not doing tracking if you don't disclose where this product is. So that's a very first step.
Right.
It's, you know, it's a smart step. Politically, people can see it. They're going to see a benefit to having this label. But it's not the last thing we have to do. It's really the first thing we have to do on GMOs.
Yeah. Well, one of the main reasons our government says they don't want to label GMOs is because they say that consumers will be confused. Meanwhile, we have labels that have everything else on it, and a lot of the things are confusing. People still don't know what they're looking at. You know, you read some of the ingredients, and you have no idea what they are. What do you say to that when people say, you know, the consumers will be confused?
Yeah, that's very convenient in this fight for
right.
that. And if that was their standard, you know, grocery packages would look a lot different, right? We wouldn't see... Yeah, I mean, I'm like a crazy person in the grocery store because I'm looking at all the labels and they just make me so mad. I mean, the word natural is really essentially undefined legally and is essentially can be put on almost anything. That's confusing. If folks who in the food processing industry were so worried about their customers being confused, they wouldn't use that word natural, which is meaningless. I mean, there's a long list of misleading labels and things that happen for them to try to sell us more products. But conveniently, when it's something they don't want to disclose, suddenly they're very worried about our information level. They're very worried about our welfare. They're
right.
happy to put labels on for any number of other things that people may or may not be asking for. But when it comes to something that they would be forced to put on, they don't want to do it. And we've had the same fight over nutrition facts and ingredient labels. Those aren't on there by choice. Those are on there because the law makes these companies disclose those basic things. And there were fights about getting those labels on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the funniest is when you see, you know, like something that never had trans fat in them marked no trans fat or
exactly.
gluten-free, you know, like on top of broccoli, you know?
And like fat-free jelly beans, you know, like things that are just straight sugar that are suddenly fat-free because they think that people will buy it for that reason. But I think that's confusing, but they're not worried about that because they think it sells more jelly beans.
Right. Hey. So I know Food and Water Watch has also involved, you know, getting Governor Cuomo to prohibit fracking in New York State. But I was just talking about that earlier in my show, that they're importing fracked gas from Pennsylvania with radon in it. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, I don't spend as much time on this, but I did check with our folks in New York, and they were saying, you know, yes, that's absolutely a concern. So, you know, New York is not going to drill because of the, you know, the great organizing work that people across the state did to get the governor to say he wasn't going to allow it. But there is still gas, you know, happening in your neighbors in Pennsylvania and other places, and there's still gas moving around. And so the particular region of the Marcellus Shale where this gas is coming from is prone to having radon. And so I grew up in Pennsylvania, and we were always testing for radon in our house, right? I mean, it's just a fact of the geology there. So it is a concern if you're...
No, I didn't say anything.
So it is a concern. You know, if you're bringing in gas from places like Pennsylvania and they have radon in it, what are you going to end up with in a building where you're burning gas in a furnace? So I know that there is a bill Assemblywoman Rosenthal from New York City has introduced in the state legislature to try to get a handle on that and to put some limits on the radon levels in gas. So that's an important move to keep an eye on. And then there's still lots of other work in New York, even though you're not going to have drilling. There's still a lot of work to be done to make sure you don't end up with pipelines, you know, and compressor stations and the export terminals to turn it into liquid natural gas to ship it off. That kind of puts you still in that gas system, even if you're not drilling there. So there's a bunch of things still happening on that fight.
Mm-hmm. So do you know, are they already bringing the gas in, or that's something that's proposed with the Spectrum pipeline?
You know what, I'm actually not the right one to ask that. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm not sure exactly. I think that there's plans afoot to bring in more, but I'm not positive whether or not it's already coming in. But there are folks in our New York City office that could totally give you an update
on that.
Okay.
I will check and let all of you listeners out there know, because I had heard that there already was gas coming in with radon in it. And, you know, of course, that concern became even more highlighted when there was that big explosion down in New York this past week. And also, you know, a lot of our dairy comes from Pennsylvania, and those animals are all drinking that water from many of which could be contaminated with fracked gas. And I was just wondering whether or not we have to be worried about the organic dairy that's coming in from Pennsylvania, or any of the dairy, even not the organic.
Again, it's a really good question, and it shows how we're dealing with a new development or a new technology, and we don't necessarily have a system in place to track it. So we've asked that question of the folks who run the National Organic Program, like, what are you doing to track this? And they're aware of it, and, I know that they've talked to there's the USDA sets the standards, and then there's these certifying bodies who go out and inspect organic farms. I know that they're having this conversation, but there isn't yet any standard, that X or Y will happen. But we have, at this point, we're relying on, those farmers to do a good job and be conscientious and keep their animals healthy. And it just shows how we're trying to make up for this stuff because we haven't regulated the fracking in the first place, right? It just causes this ripple effect of questions about what happens to the environment and why the environment matters. It's where our food is coming from. So it's kind of an unanswered question at this point, and it just shows how we have to get a handle on the practice that's causing the problems in the first place, the fracking.
Absolutely. Because, just like when you eat animals, even if you buy animals that where it says, if it says that it's not being fed GMO feed, that's great. But if you're eating animals that are hormone antibiotic free, that says nothing to what their feed is. Their feed is all genetically modified feed. And so you are getting secondhand GMO just by eating those animals. And so, the same way, a baby is healthy depending on what their mother ate, we are products of what we eat. And, if you're eating animals that are eating GMO products, even if you're trying to avoid GMOs, you have to think about that because that is a way of ingesting it. And, a lot of the studies are showing that the GMO, especially the BT, stays producing that pesticide even inside your body after it's been ingested. So I think, it could even transfer from the animal to the person. And that's something else I think people have to really be aware of when they're, choosing what they're going to eat.
Yeah, absolutely. It just shows, it puts a burden on consumers, but that's where we are right now. And so then it leads us to just trying to give advice about how you navigate this. And so there are some labels that mean a lot, and there's some labels that really don't mean anything. And the best advice I can give people is to be your most suspicious, cynical self when you're in the grocery store and you're looking at those labels. If they're telling you one thing, then they're only telling you one thing, right? No antibiotics means just that. No antibiotics. It doesn't mean that animal had this idyllic life on a giant pasture to themselves and, never saw the inside of a barn or anything like that. It just means no antibiotics, right? So you have to be literal-minded, when you're when you're reading those things. There are some labels that tell you more. Organic tells you a bunch of things when it comes to animals. It means no GMO feed, no antibiotics, no hormones. So that is a bunch of things bundled into one, and that's a pretty rigorous label because we have that standard-setting process I was talking about. But there's other labels that go big like that, but don't necessarily have the backing. And so you got to do a lot of your homework at home, not in the store.
Absolutely.
And look them up online and see which labels give you what you want in terms of verification and really clear standards, and then go look for those labels.
Right. Being a chef is so helpful because sometimes, I was looking at something yesterday that was, organic. I think they were organic pot stickers. And so I'm looking at the ingredient list, and the ingredient list was so long, filled with so many things that I know don't need to go into a pot sticker. I make my own, and it's like, so they might be organic fillers, but they're still fillers. There's still crap in it. And so, even something that says organic, it might be bitter crap than non-organic. But if there's too many ingredients, and there are ingredients that don't need to go into that, don't buy it,
Yeah, exactly. And keeping your wits about you in a store and using your head and thinking, what does that long ingredient list need to be? That's exactly right. If you absolutely have to buy that processed food, then I think the organic version is going to be give you something more. You know what those raw materials came from. They didn't use GMOs. They didn't use, you know, synthetic fertilizers and pesticides. And that's a good thing, at least environmentally. But yeah, you know, organic calories are still calories. Organic sugar is still not great for you. It doesn't mean it's without guilt or without consequences. It just means it came from a different agriculture system, and you still got to use your head about processed foods and what you really need to buy.
Absolutely. So let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk about the work you're doing with antibiotics and hormones in factory farms, because I know that's a big area that you're working on, and that's one that's really important to everybody to know about. So everyone out there, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Patty Lovera from Food and Water Watch, and I'll be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome to I Eat Green. I've been talking with Patty Lovera from Food and Water Watch, and we are just about to talk about antibiotics and hormones in factory farms. Patty, are you with me?
Mm-hmm. Hi.
Hi. So can you please share with us what's going on with antibiotic use and hormone use in factory farms? I know we're trying to phase it out. There's lots of talk about it in the news. People have heard that McDonald's is going to be phasing it out. Can you share with us where that is at and if the use of antibiotics and hormones is going down at all? I actually heard it was going up. So can you shed some light on that?
Sure. So, you know, factory farms are an environment that's tough on the animals. And is actually, if you use a drug like antibiotics, that basically you're creating a perfect environment to create bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics, the way that they get used in large-scale agriculture. And this is really across all the types of animals. They might use different drugs in different ways, but they're essentially all relying on this, the largest farms. And so there's been concern for decades that agriculture and, you know, livestock production has been overusing antibiotics because they're not necessarily using them to treat sick animals. They're using them, like, routinely over long periods of time with possibly low levels, which is actually a perfect environment for selecting for bacteria that no longer die when they're exposed to that antibiotic. So you've created these antibiotic-resistant kind of superbugs, and then they're the ones that are going to end up sticking around. They end up out in a larger environment, and there's a lot more science showing us that this has now been a source of some antibiotic-resistant bacteria that eventually make people sick and are harder to treat because they don't respond to the antibiotics that we use. So this has been an issue since the 70s, and the federal government has not had the backbone to stand up to these industries. And we actually don't have a very good handle on the problem and the amounts, and we have endless bickering about who's using what percentage of the drugs because we don't have any requirement that the meat industry keep track of how they're using the drugs, and we just have sales data, like this many pounds of drugs were sold, but we don't get good data on how they're using them, treating sick animals versus, you know, making them grow faster, kind of propping them up in this factory farm system. So there's been a lot of activity around this lately after many decades of, you know, scientists worrying about it and food advocates talking about it. In the last couple of years, we've really seen things kind of come to a head, probably in part because the public is now more aware of what happens when our antibiotics don't work and the stakes. So the FDA, about a year and a half ago, put out some new rules for the industry that don't do everything we need them to do. They closed one loophole that let these drugs get overused, but they left another loophole wide open. So that's incomplete, but that's where they kind of want to stop. And so there's a big fight to try to get the FDA to finish the job, and actually there's a bill in Congress that would change what's legal to do with these antibiotics by the meat industry. In the meantime, there's been a lot of pressure on big food companies to change their policies, and so the most recent announcement came from McDonald's a couple of weeks ago. They said that they're going to take 2 years to do it, but that they are going to change the sourcing of what chicken they will buy, and that they will, by 2 years' time, they will only buy chicken that comes from producers that don't use antibiotics, you know, in these non-therapeutic ways, in these low-dose, routine-level ways.
Mm-hmm. Right, so they still can use antibiotics, to treat a sick animal, but not prophylactically.
Right, that's the core issue with a lot of this. But as with any good political fight, there's a lot of devil in the details. So for years, the drugs were labeled to say you could use this antibiotic to promote growth, just to make the animal grow faster. They're not allowed to say that anymore, but they can still say that they're using it for disease prevention, which sounds better. It sounds more more specific and more, more targeted than growth promotion. But disease prevention is not disease treatment. So we're not arguing about whether you treat an animal that's sick. If the animal is sick, you should treat it. What we're talking about is using it, routinely, prophylactically over long periods of time. We're not preventing disease with antibiotics. You treat diseases with antibiotics.
Right. I heard a statistic that like 70% of all the antibiotics produced in the country is used for livestock. Have you heard that?
Yeah, actually, we've even heard higher, and this is where some of the bickering goes on. So what we have to do, and different experts have gone and looked at yearly sales data, just the pharmaceutical industry saying we sold this many antibiotics in total, and then basically people are subtracting what we know gets used in human medicine. And I've heard as high as 80% ending up in agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that going into animal agriculture. So it's a huge percentage. And then we get into bickering about, well, how much of that was to actually treat sick animals, which is probably a use that's going to stay around, versus how much of it was for these, prophylactic, non-therapeutic uses. Talking to the industry and talking to, farmers who don't use this, the majority is being used in these irresponsible ways. That's what we have to get a handle on. But the FDA has never required that data. So instead, we end up having these fights about the data. But we know the vast majority of antibiotics are going into agriculture.
Mm-hmm. When we go talk about labeling, I find it funny when Trader Joe's, for instance, they will label that their dairy is RBST-free, which is the hormone that, has been associated with so many problems, or one of the hormones. But anyway, they label, in order to label that their product is free of that hormone, they have to also put a little thing underneath saying that there's no proof that that hormone is dangerous. And yet they're concerned about food labeling. It's just crazy to me.
Well, that's the politics of labeling. There's always politics, and that was a big fight 8 or 10 years ago, and even longer. Initially when RBGH or RBST came on the market, a lot of folks justifiably said, I don't want this, and a bunch of companies responded and said, all right, we won't use it, and we'll tell you that. And there was tremendous pressure on companies, and actually Ben & Jerry's was in the forefront of this. They actually went to court to defend their right to say we're not using RBGH. And then years later, that kind of went along for a while, and then years later, the producer of RBGH, at that time it was Monsanto, they've since sold this drug to somebody else, at that point they went to different state legislatures and they went to the FDA and they tried to ban that RBGH-free label. They tried to make it illegal to tell consumers that something wasn't being used, which I found extraordinary, and that was a big fight.
Right,
and so
I remember.
What came out of that fight was that you could do it, but you have to put that, that kind of absurd disclaimer, which is how it kind of ended up in the wash after this big fight about whether you could even disclose something that consumers are clearly interested in.
Right. It's amazing to me. At the current rate of production, do you think there's enough chickens being raised without antibiotics and hormones? And if a big company like McDonald's is now saying that they want to only source chickens with antibiotics and hormone-free, how is that going to change the marketplace, and the factory farms?
Right, well, that's the million-dollar question. There's a very clear, public health need to change the way these drugs are being used. Like, we have a public health crisis when antibiotics don't work, when people get sick, and, one way to tackle that crisis is to stop overusing them in agriculture. So that in and of itself is worth fighting for, but it may not necessarily, end the factory farm system. We're going to have to still tackle that, and so that's, a bigger conversation. And we worry a little bit when we hear that all of this change is just coming from private companies, because and not changing the rules, you know, not having the FDA and Congress say you just can't do this anymore, because there's always an outlet for the stuff that's not making the cut. You know, for somebody, some buyer has very specific standards. There's usually, a cheaper product they might funnel the other stuff into, something that isn't going to be watched as carefully or as labeled. And it's also just tough for us as consumers to really verify what the companies are doing. It's not really a transparent process when it's just their company policy. So it's progress, you know, which shows that these companies are hearing it and that they realize the public doesn't want this to happen, but we need to finish the job and make it illegal, basically, to use these drugs improperly.
Right,
so, you know, that's, they also gave themselves, McDonald's gave themselves 2 years, Chick-fil-A gave themselves 5 years, so they're working with big suppliers and they're easing this in.
With so many of the large, I'm changing the subject just a little bit. With large corporations buying up these smaller organic companies, one of the things that I've been really concerned about is these larger companies pushing the National Organic Standards Board to weaken their organic standards. And for me, as someone who's been buying organic for so long, I really depend on trusting that there's safety in buying organic. What can the public do to try to, you know, to encourage the Organic Standards Board to really stay transparent and to stay honest with their mission, and to withstand the pressure from the larger corporations?
Yeah, that's a really important point. It's a really good question. So I think, you know, a year ago, I probably wouldn't, not as many people knew about the level of consolidation and just how many of these brands that a lot of, you know, really dedicated organic consumers have been buying for a long time, that they might now be owned by a much bigger kind of conventional food company. And there's a long list. We actually have a bunch of graphics about that on a website called foodopoly.org, where people can check out. And it's a very important point, is what happens to their commitment to, you know, the organic principles and the organic movement that started 30 years ago. Is that going to be the same when we have these big, you know, corporate agribusinesses in the mix? And it worries us too. So the one thing I can say is the organic industry has their fights in public. They air their dirty laundry in public. We don't see that in a lot of other sectors of the food supply. And you mentioned the National Organic Standards Board. So there is a board. They meet twice a year publicly. They're going to meet at the end of the month, actually, in California. And they talk about this stuff and they vote on what the organic standard should be. They spend a lot of time talking about specific chemicals or materials. You know, can you use this in organic? You know, we're not supposed to use synthetics. Will we make an exception for this one material? So they do spend a lot of time airing that out. And then ultimately it's up to the USDA to do a good job putting those recommendations into effect. So there are public comment periods. So if you, you know, are on a list of a group like Food and Water Watch or Center for Food Safety or somebody like that, we'll tell you when it's time to comment, and that's important. And also, I think we need to, you know, educate folks about who is owning these companies, so that they understand the full, you know, the full chain, and people might make decisions based on that. So part of it is education, and part of it is staying tuned for when those public comment periods open up and getting involved in them. And you can tell the companies as well. You know, they have customer service lines, and they have, you know, their Facebook pages, and they have to listen to that. They're consumer-facing products, and you can express that to them too.
Right. But like the National Organic Standards Board is supposed to be a makeup of, I don't really know what the breakdown is, but a certain number of people from corporations and a certain number of people from agriculture and a certain number of people from small organic companies, you know, that kind of breakup. And I've heard that almost, you know, the majority of the people have some sort of link of conflict of interest, you know, that they've, you know, that the people that were supposed to be on that are like from small organic companies, let's say, are really ones that are now being owned by the larger companies. So that the safety net that was supposedly built in to the transparency of the makeup of the people on that board has changed. Is there anything that people can do about that?
Well, there is. It's a good point, and we've shared that concern at different points. It's had, you know, it's kind of ebbed and flowed. There's been a couple couple versions of the board that we were really discouraged by. There's been some progress in recent years. So it does, you know, it does vary. There's 15 people on the board, and the law that created the federal organic label says, you know, this many seats go to farmers, this many seats go to consumers, this many, there's a seat for scientists. So they have these spelled out roles. Actually, just in the last couple of days, the USDA announced, and they're there for specific terms, for a five-year term. And so a couple people just finished their term, and there are a couple openings that just, I think they literally just this week put out the announcement for vacancies, so people could find that on the USDA website and take a look and see if they know somebody that would be good on that. And you can, you know, mobilize support and say, hey, this is somebody who represents, you know, the consumer community or the farmer community. So it is it can be frustrating, but it's the process we have. So a lot of groups do spend time looking at it. And we have had successes. You know, a few years ago, there was a big fight, a pretty serious fight in that process about the way antibiotics actually had been allowed for a long time to treat a certain disease in organic fruit trees. And it still happens in conventional, but the question was whether organic should be allowed to use these antibiotics to treat this disease. And it was, there were folks saying, you know, we need this tool, we don't have anything else. And there were folks like us saying, you've had enough time, this is a credibility issue for the organic label. And we had that fight in public, and the board voted to end the use of those antibiotics. So we can go into that process and change the standards, but you're right that we do have to keep an eye on the process itself. And there's actually a little bit of a situation right now, a bunch of groups are challenging something about the rules of that board because we don't want it to become an unlevel playing field. So we're working to keep that process open.
Right. And another thing, when we're talking about standards, so many people have concerns about all the organic produce that's coming in from other countries. You know, what are the standards in other countries? What is that process of, you know, verifying that the farmers really are doing it in according to organic standards? Do we have any certification like that?
Yeah, so the way it's supposed to work is that when something has the USDA organic label, no matter where it comes from, that was supposed to be inspected by, there's about 100 entities that the USDA says are allowed to go out and inspect for the organic label. Some of them operate in foreign countries, and so USDA says that, you know, this certifying agency is going out and they're checking for our USDA standards. So that's the way that it's supposed to work. There have been some breakdowns in that process. I'm not going to pretend that it's perfect. And so we tell people, you know, the ideal is USDA organic that's from the U.S., one, because we have a little more confidence in that inspection process and certification process, but two, just because we want, you know, organic is a better system of agriculture. It's cleaner. It's better for farmers' health and community health and all those things. We want those benefits to be happening here, right? And we don't want to not be building the organic sector here because it is, you know, a much more environmentally sound system of production. I want to convert acres to organic in the United States, so we need to create that market here and get U.S. farmers to switch. Right. So, absolutely. That's why we fight for country of origin labels, too. So you can look for the U.S. label, and you can look for the organic label, and that's what we want to see.
Right. And so everyone listening, that means you have to start transitioning to eating seasonally. You cannot expect to get raspberries and blueberries in the middle of the winter and think they're going to be coming from our country, because that's not happening. Maybe strawberries, right, from California, but you got to get organic ones. Anyway, Patty, thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I really wanted to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but I'm not going to get to it this time. So, you know, because that's an issue we all have to watch out for, because that can really affect our protection of what countries are allowed to do. So we'll talk more about that another time. But everyone, you're going to be a guest at the Long Island Food Conference talking about a lot of these issues. You have a whole panel to yourself on, or not panel, a whole workshop on food policy. So a lot of these questions we can delve into there. So thank you for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me. I'll see you soon at the conference.
Yes, you will. And everybody out there, thank you so much for joining us and listening. It's been a pleasure, and I will be with you again next Thursday. Bye for now.